gives me an opportunity to grow a little bit and hear something new. So now I think it's time to imagine the future. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mr. Stephen Downs.
If I ever write a book, I'll call the book Kakadu. Kakadu is a park, a beautiful park in northern Australia, about 2 hours drive east of Darwin. It's the place where you saw all those Crocodile Dundee movies. Kakadu is filled with alligators and birds and termites, and as you can see from the illustration here, drawings on the sides of caves. And I was able to take pictures of those drawings on the sides of caves. You know, and we have this tendency to think of these pictures as just pictures, and we have the tendency to think of the people who drew them as primitives and unaware of their society. I used these images in some talks in 2004. I used this image here along with the slogan, how did it go? We remember, or we learn about the future in the same way that we learn about the past, by reading the signs. You know, this drawing that was created by the Aboriginals in northern Australia, who knows when, is obviously an artifact of the past, as it was for them, because it's depicting something that they had caught. And if you look at it closely, something that they had dissected. But it was also a way for them to learn about the future, to learn what such a fish would look like when they caught it, what parts were good to eat, what parts were bad to eat, how to deal with the future eventuality of catching such a fish. The same artifact, the very same artifact that was a relic of the past, is also a totem for the future. You will be creating a slideshow for this talk. I'm way too lazy for that. No, I'm just kidding. If you go to the website listed there on the screen, you will find a submission form. Into that submission form, if you have wireless access, you can enter any content. If you enter content into that submission form and click submit, it will be displayed on that screen. The order it was received for a period of 10 seconds. Now, I've done this on a number of previous occasions, and then four or five occasions. On all previous occasions, the organizers of the conference have come to me after to apologize for how their membership behaved. The forms will accept HTML, so you can style your text. Add images, YouTube videos, and the computer is wired for sound. So if you can figure out how to get something that produces sound for 10 seconds to autoplay when it is launched on a screen, you will be able to contribute to the audio portion of this talk as well. And there is a way to do it. I will meanwhile be working from my slides here, which I've lost. If you want to view these slides later, you can access them from my website, the address for which I will show you at the end of this talk. Thanks for modeling with us. I can see the messages here, too, by the way. I have learned from past experience, one of the things I have learned is don't have it so that you can't see the comments when they come up. Because the audience will inevitably react to the comment and I have no idea what they're reacting to, and it creates a state of confusion and perplexity. And I don't like being confused and perplexed, well, at least not much. Anyhow, the talk is called 10 Futures. You know, there are people, and you've heard this, I'm sure, many times, people who say, you cannot predict the future. There's no way to know what the future will hold. And that is, if I may be frank, patently absurd. You've all been walking around. When you crossed the road, did you think it was safe to cross the road on the red light or the green light? Now, I'm sure some of you cross on the red light, so I'm not going to ask the question that way. But you didn't cross the road when the light was red and there was traffic approaching, did you? Why not? Well, because you can predict the future. You know what will happen if you walk in front of a truck. You walk in front of a truck, the truck will hit you, you will fall down, you will hit your head, you will die. That's a prediction of the future. And it's a very reliable prediction of the future, and that kind of prediction of the future governs many of our actions. A prediction of the immediate future is very simple. I have a coin. What will happen when I let go of this coin? Any predictions? Yeah. Pretty easy to demonstrate. Everybody got that one right. But predictions get a little bit harder as we go out into the future, just as descriptions of the past get harder as we go into the progress of the past, right? We have to look more deeply into the artifacts, we have to look more deeply into the signs in order to be able to predict in the future, just as we have to look at the signs in order to be able to tell ourselves about the past. Now you might ask, well, what does this have to do with educational technology? This has everything to do with educational technology, because everything that we're talking about at this conference, and indeed, interestingly, any conference, even conferences of historians, which creates an interesting epistemological puzzle, everything that we're talking about at this conference has to do with the future, what the future holds, what new technology there will be, how that will change teaching practices, how that will change our lives in the future and our students' lives in the future. And if you think you can't predict the future, this conference isn't going to be very useful to you, is it? But you can predict the future, and that's the message I want to give you. You can predict the future, and you can predict it reliably. So let's have some fun predicting the future. And Darcy, pay attention. I've been talking through a number of slides. I'm now catching up to myself. All right. First prediction. The pragmatic web. Now, you've all heard of the semantic web, right? The semantic web, the web of meaning, all of that. Tim Berners-Lee, you've probably seen instances of it. RDF, resource description framework, XML, web services, you know, choreograph, web service, all of that sort of thing. The semantic web, thus described, may give us meaning, but what the semantic web will not give us is context. Because semantics is only one part of the theory of communication, the theory of science. I always go back to Charles Morris, who wrote in 1938, Foundations of the Theory of Science. Nobody reads that book, believe me. And he distinguishes between syntax, which is the grammar or the structure of a communication system, and semantics, which is the system of meaning generated in the communication system, and that may be reference or representation or various other systems of meaning. And then third, pragmatics, and that is the way we use the system of meaning. In the pragmatic web, our tools, our content, won't simply contain meaning, it will contain elements of use. Your tools will know who you are. Your tools will know what you are doing. Your tools will know who you've been talking to, what you know, what you knew, and probably what you will know tomorrow. Your tools will know where you are, where you want to go, and where you have been, and your tools will also know what the weather is like outside. And this pragmatic web will use all this information. It is chock full of information, but it will use this knowledge to make sure that the information it presents to you is never off topic, and that it is never beyond your understanding. But also that it is, wow, that's impressive. But also that is somebody figured out the HTML. But that's not a live shot. That's from yesterday. I first thought, oh, that's a live shot. There isn't. But it's never beyond your understanding. Interesting remark about cognitive load, isn't it? The pragmatic web isn't just the web that we access, that we read and write. It isn't just a communications medium. We think of the web as a communications medium today. But it's also the web that you use every day. It becomes the tool that you use in the conduct of your ordinary activities. You want to talk about cognitive overload? Imagine giving a presentation and reading this stuff. It was interesting watching Alan November talk yesterday. And one of the habits that he has, I don't know if he noticed it, but I noticed it. Every once in a while, he'd stop, he'd make a statement like, you know, the web of the future will be the pragmatic web. And then he would say something like, do you believe this? Interesting rhetorical device, right? Because it forces you to stop, forces you to think, forces you to evaluate and not just consume. And so I end this segment on the pragmatic web, which doesn't really sound like much of a prediction, but there it is, asking, do you believe this? More to the point, assuming that the pragmatic web is a viable prediction, of course I always assume that, what do we learn from this? Well, look at the method, look at the mechanism that I use to come up with this prediction. I use some knowledge that I have from another domain, an obscure book in philosophy. It's actually not that obscure, it's fairly foundational. But some knowledge in another domain applied to the current context. In philosophy, we have syntax, semantics, pragmatics. On the web, we have syntax, semantics. What do you think comes next? How accurate do you think that prediction is now? When you see it here, you have two of the three things here, they seem really inevitable, doesn't it? Patterns repeat. What we see in one domain, and especially what we see in a theoretical domain, and I'll come back to that, often shows up in another domain. And that's something you can use to predict the future. Second prediction. I need to be careful because I have about an hour. I have 10 predictions. 10 predictions. And 60 minutes, which gives me 6 minutes per prediction. Minus time for the introduction, asides, jokes, etc., which gives me about 2 minutes per prediction. Second prediction, global intelligence. Now, we think that our computers are smart, and our computers are getting very smart. We think about things like Big Blue. Big Blue is that IBM computer that defeated the world chess champion. That's very smart. And you people in University of Alberta, Rob, I forgot his last name. Oh, that's horrible. Anyhow, he was part of the team that built the world's best checker playing computer. And in fact, their computer solved checkers, literally solved checkers. It is now mathematically impossible to beat that computer of checkers, because that computer knows every possible permutation of the game. So our computers are going to be pretty intelligent, but our computer network will dwarf that intelligence. Our computer network won't be just the invisible hand of the marketplace. It will be the whole body. And our computer network, this invisible body of the whatever, won't focus simply on one single value, like capital or money, but a whole range of different values, a multiplicity of measures. It will be composed of multidimensional interactions of wide varieties of media, including all of the things that we call media, television, radio, news, but also things like money, money transactions, things like votes, voting systems, things like population movements, traffic, things like utilities, power consumption, water consumption, gas consumption, production, resources, minerals, food. All of these sources of information combined and represented and used as value arrays on a worldwide grid or network of computers. And this will be an intelligent network. And I'll tell you right away, we won't understand it. Way too large for people like us. Because there's no way to have a perspective on that network, is there? We won't know what the worldwide grid or the worldwide brain is trying to do. We won't know what it wants. We won't know what it thinks is good and bad. We won't know even if it is sane or balanced. Of course, there won't be any shortage of evangelists out there ready to say they see what the world brain knows. They know what the world brain wants. But it's okay, because the global brain will not affect and indeed will be completely indifferent to the lives of humans for the most part. If you think about the personal relationship you have with one neuron in your brain, there is nothing, right? You are completely indifferent to the activities of any neuron in your brain. And in exactly the same way, the global mind will be completely indifferent to the activities of any individual human. How do I know this? Because it's exactly the same system, exactly the same structure, just on a different scale. Scales matter. But the global mind is the sort of thing that will raise very serious and important questions about the meaning of life, the value of ethics, and the nature of knowledge. And we ask, how will we answer these questions? And our answers to these questions over the next few decades, over the next few centuries, even as things like climate change and resource shortages and all of that ravage our populations, the way we answer these questions would be as fundamental as any other force in society. So what do we learn from that sort of prediction? How do we know, how does that prediction tell us about how we can go about predicting the future? Well, first of all, something very important to keep in mind when we're predicting the future is that although things are important, combinations of things are even more important, and generally tend to be more powerful than individual things. So when you're predicting the future, don't restrict your predictions to things. Predict how combinations of things will interact. Second, and very important, a lot of what happens in the world is outside our own domain of knowledge, outside our canon. And that is as important to think about as what we will know about what will be obvious and evident to us. The questions we will ask in the future are as important to think about as the answers we will be able to find. Third prediction, third future. Just as an aside, I love asides. This is me going to the side. It's an old joke that I love. These are 10 independent futures. They're not necessarily related to each other, so I'm not going to be bound by any requirement of consistency. Although, if all of them come true, the next thing you would want to do is imagine a world in which all of these things are true at the same time. Third future, extended reality. Well, today we distinguish between the real world physicality and the virtual world. Somebody trying to, let me fix that. I don't know how that happened. Cognitive overload, you know? Alright, we distinguish between the real world and physicality. And the virtual world of the digital. And in the future, this distinction will blur. And believe me, it will blur in a big way. The non-physical will be seen to be as real as the physical. I mean that in a total concrete kind of sense. This is not just a conceptual blurring. This is not seeing the digital as though it were real or anything like that. This is not even the sort of blurring where, you know, the digital can have impacts or effects in the real world, and therefore the digital is real because it has a causal impact in the real world. No. This is a complete fusion of the digital and the real. You're lost. Let me show you what I mean. We will have a full sensory coupling with the virtual world. The virtual world will be every bit as real to us as the real world. For example, if it hurts in the digital world, it will hurt. Period. Basically, what will emerge is a combination of virtual and physical that will create perceptual, a kind of hyper-reality, where we perceive virtual and physical using the same senses and with the same sensory modalities, where objects will exist in both the physical world and the digital world. If you think this is really hard to imagine, go read the works of a guy called Baruch Spinoza. Baruch Spinoza was a philosopher who wrote around about the same time as Descartes. And Descartes, when he wrote, Descartes, you remember, like, I think therefore I am, or the vegetable version, I think therefore I am. I'm sorry. Descartes is famous for distinguishing between mind and body. And but Descartes said, well, that's a property of humans, right? Humans, mind and body, everything else is just body. Spinoza comes along and says, everything's got a mind. Everything has a physical dimension and a spiritual dimension. That rock, it's got soul.
Well, he didn't say it that way, but that's what he meant.
But in the digital world, with multimodal perceptions, every object in the world will have a physical component and a virtual component. And the virtual component, because it's perceived directly by us, will be as real to us as the physical component. The physical world and the virtual world will act as one. Each in the virtual world and in the physical world, your body will receive nutrition. How could this possibly be? Well, I'll give you an example. Money. Is money real or virtual? When we spend money, which really, when you think about it, especially my bank account, it's very virtual. But when you spend money, do we get real or virtual goods in return? Money is an abstraction. It is a concept. It is an idea. It is not real. Most of the money that exists in the world does not exist in dollar bills or $2 coins or whatever. It exists as nothing more than an abstraction. But this abstraction has very real consequences.
It is indistinguishable. The virtual, that is money, and the reality, that is money, is indistinguishable. That is already the case today.
And it is indeed a fact that it can be both digital, virtual, and real. It makes money so useful.
But other things will become useful in this way in the future. But think about it.
Think back to the days when money really was tangible. When money was, quite literally, gold. If you had said, man, money will become virtual, you would have thought, no. Other things, money would be the last thing anybody would make virtual, right? If anything is going to stay real and physical, it's going to be money, because if money isn't gold, then what is it?
Compared to making money virtual, making things like access to food and drugs and other stuff and delivered using bio-neural devices, that's child's play. And so we're going to do it. So what do we learn about predicting the future from that kind of vision? Well, first of all, sacred cows aren't. The things that we think are most permanent and most forever, like the distinction between real and virtual, are the things that are going to change, and when they change will cause the greatest consequence. Think about the change in our society that was created when money went from being gold to being credit. The things that you think could never change are the things that will create the most change when they disappear. So when you're making your own predictions, think about the thing that could never change. Imagine the thing that could change that, and imagine the world after that. Most of you are working in schools and in education system. You think, or may think, the thing that could not change is the school. The school could never disappear. Well, imagine if it did. What would you do? What would your job be? Would you have a job? I would argue, yes, you would.
Future number four, mobility. We will become nomads again. I mean nomadic in the sense of long-term, slow migrations over territory, the way the old nomads did it. Not, the breakneck commuting with cars and jet aircraft that we do today. We will, if you will, graze on energy and information resources as they become available, as we gradually wander through the world. This won't be just some idle phenomenon. This will be a social, a society-wide change. And indeed, people... people who... are, as we say today, rooted, will be considered eccentric, unable to adapt, unable to cope with the changes of the new modern world. They will be viewed in the future the way we view tribal nomads of the past. Right? Just unable to, just not part of mainstream society. I'm trying to think of different ways of saying it. You're dead Israel. There you go. But is your credit real? You might say, well, why did this happen? Well, first of all, we're not going to be in a state of material want in the future. Already, even today, our productive capacity outstrips our labor supply. We produce many, many more things than we have the capacity to produce much more than we could ever possibly consume. So we have a phenomenon we call it unemployment. We actually have people who are unable to find productive employment. And add to that the fact that most of what we produce we don't actually need. We've actually had to build a culture of consumerism in order to sustain this productive capacity at all. But consumerism is not sustainable. And moreover, as we move into the world in which the digital becomes real, the the digital remember is something that can be produced with the mind alone, everybody will be able to produce wealth. There will not be any single class of people that has a unique hold over, as they say, the means of production. This is the source of the economic revolution happening in places like India today. People in India today don't need to build things and send them to Canada. They just need to do things like code and web design and online poker and stuff like that. They can create wealth. And I'm not joking when I say online poker. I'm not joking if I say people in India are working in online games to produce wealth. But the point here is they can produce it simply with their thought. So what will happen in this kind of world is there won't be any wealth properly so-called. There will be abundance but not wealth, because wealth is produced by accumulation, by hoarding, by keeping for oneself. And that won't be necessary anymore. There won't be any artificially imposed scarcity. And indeed, wealth will be looked at as odd and unusual and even aberrant. Consumer goods, like, say, books, will be thought of as a wealthy man's folly. Nobody would really keep books. Why would anyone keep books? You can have the entire library of anything ever created by humans on your keychain. Why would you have books? But wealthy people who like to hoard things, we will view them as odd eccentrics, will hoard books. The rest of society will view these rooted, hoarding people as very strange, and this odd behavior, accurately, as a sign of probable criminal activity. So what do we learn from this kind of prediction? Well, first, values matter. And what we value matters. What we value changes the way we live in society. But our values, our way of life, is something that is learned. Something that is a reaction, a way of coping with our environment. Change our environment, remove, say, scarcity, or remove, say, cheap oil, and our way of life and our values change. So when you're thinking about the future, thinking about the changes we know are going to happen, and there are lots of changes we know are going to happen, like, for example, we will run out of oil. That's a prediction, that's a pretty safe one. And ask, what would you value if this sort of thing would change? And understanding what we would value tells you a lot about how you would live your life. How do I get the nomad prediction? Well, the value that changes is we don't value the accumulation of goods anymore. Well, if we don't value the accumulation of goods anymore, why on earth would we stay in one place? Feature number five. The human grid. I was hoping for more creative slides. I'll just say. You guys could be putting links in there. You could be putting photos, graphs, diagrams, videos, and we're getting try that on Darfur. We could talk about Darfur if you want, but I'm not going to go there. But I mean, Darfur is a question of there isn't enough grain in the world to feed them. We know that. Darfur is a question of hoarding and scarcity and the imposition of power as a consequence of wealth, which, as we know, is aberrant and probably criminal behavior. Right? So we'll leave that aside. Okay. Human minds, the human mind, including this one, they are efficient and effective processing systems. Very efficient, very effective. They are, moreover, able to assimilate megabytes, indeed terabytes, of information in seconds. Excellent receiving devices. They're excellent pattern recognition devices. I could look out here and there's, I don't know how many hundreds of people, several hundred people, and I can see somebody I recognize in a matter of seconds, or I could, I had better eyes. Human minds are good at making decisions. We are, in fact, rational. If we weren't rational, we would be dead. And we are not dead, therefore we are rational. And human minds, human brains, are good communicators. Human brains have the capacity, whether inborn or not, we can leave that debate to the side, they have the capacity for language, they have the capacity for communication. Hence, human contributions to the economy, which is, I'll put this in brackets, because most people think economy, money, I think of economy as the system of production of material goods for the sustainment of life. Human contributions to the economy will consist of providing inputs, because that's what we do, providing inputs to the machines that actually do the work. I think, well, that's kind of a strange way of, yeah, okay. Think of driving a tractor. The tractor does the work. The human driving the tractor serves as the tractor's input device and decision-making system. Right? Because you look where you're going and then you steer. So exactly the same phenomenon, only across society. We will derive value in the future by enabling human minds to cooperate in the coordination of the operation of the elements of production. Our human minds working together will organize and manage the system of production of the economy that creates the material goods we need in order to sustain life. But how? How is the question? And simply, we will function as perceiving devices, deciding devices, and communications devices. In a very general sense, right? We will contribute to the global web our thoughts on, and our opinions on everything. From celebrities, to the weather, to tomorrow's sports scores. And from this, from all of these random, seemingly unrelated, seemingly pedestrian, common, ordinary, certainly unintellectual thoughts, computational systems will derive the algorithms that process iron ore, that grow green crops, and that harvest energy from the wind and from the sun. Our computers will look at what we're talking about. Celebrity gossip, Britney Spears, Amy Winehouse, and use that knowledge to run the economy. You might think that's ridiculous. Well, even now, pop culture can be seen as a metaphor for the instruments of production. And human cognitive capacity, we know, can be mined directly by tracking thoughts and ideas and things like that as they're transferred from person to person. All kinds of ways of doing that. We have a pretty good idea what people are talking about. We have systems like Technorati and Amazon and Google and all of these things that are able to track the big topics, Michael Jackson, whatever, you know, the greats of society. And our productive capacity will be steered by this thought. Now you might think, totally implausible. Think back to, was this yesterday? I think it was just yesterday. Somebody was talking about the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. I hear there is a football team here. Didn't know that. I'm just kidding. But think about how a sports team can be used as a measure of the social and economic well-being of a society. Think about how people identify with their sports teams. People think that the way their sports teams function is reflective on their society. You know, yesterday I was hearing about the Saskatchewan Roughriders Grey Cup. Today, I don't have a good thing, I wish I did. On the newspaper, big headline, you know, Saskatchewan and Newfoundland are at the top of the world. Huh. You think it's coincidence? Riders win the Grey Cup, Saskatchewan is doing well economically? Or that is ridiculous. Or, well, that would be interesting to see why you think that's ridiculous. Think about the way the advertising industry mines pop culture in order to identify consumer needs and consumer trends of the future. Well, yes, these relationships are metaphorical, right? When I talk about sports teams and the economy, I'll bet you dollars to dollars that the person who said that is ridiculous immediately left to thinking causal relation. Well, you know, the Saskatchewan Roughriders and the economy of the province have no causal relation with each other, therefore I'm ridiculous. But they have a metaphorical relation with each other. And we are in an age, and I'll talk about this more, where metaphors become reality. The collection of these thoughts and these opinions from a network of people interacting with each other in this environment where they discuss pop stars and sports and the economy and the weather and whatever, that will come to be called the human grid. And that will be the global cognitive input system of production engine. We will produce value by doing that sort of activity. Well, you might not agree with that prediction, but I bet you you're thinking about it. And what do we learn from that kind of prediction? Well, first of all, when the environment changes, what we want to look at is where do we derive value? Where do we derive the sources for our productive capacity? Where do we derive the mechanisms for producing goods and services and distributing goods and services? You know, the history of art is illustrative. I've been reading about postmodernism, which is sort of a contradiction. We'll leave that aside. At the turn of the previous century, people invented photography, and then all of a sudden, art's primary task, which was to represent reality, was usurped by this stupid little box. Big box back then. And so what did the artist do? The artist said, well, the value that we create is no longer reproducing reality because the device that does it better. But we can preserve our value by reproducing things that box does not produce. So the artist went from reproducing reality to surrealism, reproducing things that cannot be captured by the photograph, reproducing the abstract structures of things, reproducing dynamics, movement, reproducing multiple perspectives on a single canvas. So when we look at how our environment is going to change, we look at not what is going away, we look at how we will derive value in the future, because all of us, every single one of us, will want to engage in activities that A, feed us, B, clothe us, C, house us, etc. And how will we go about these things? How will we produce value in a world where what we do now is produced by machines? Six. Smart objects. Bruce Sterling is a science fiction writer, a very good science fiction writer. He wrote a book called Distraction, which I enjoyed tremendously. And in Distraction, there's a crew of people that get together right now in Texas, New Orleans, wherever, down in that area. It's not clear exactly where they are. And they decide to build a hotel. That's what they're going to do this week because they need to do something to earn a little money. So they decide to build a hotel. So they get the materials to build the hotel. The materials arrive, a great big pile of stuff. And they go to this set of materials. And as they're looking at some materials, a piece of material, volunteers, start with me. And they pick up the piece of material. And they say, okay, take me and do such and such with me. And then go back and get this piece. And you go back and get this. And the hotel instructs the crew in how to build the hotel. And so the material itself manages its own construction.
We're going to have a lot of stuff like that. We're going to have
a lot of objects that have built-in intelligence, not just hotels, but and not just podiums and tables, but a wide variety of objects. And even more to the point, these objects that have built-in intelligence will be connected to each other. So they will be able to be aware of the world around them. They'll tap into the pragmatic web. I've talked about various examples of this in the past. The smart fishing rod. How many of you have heard my story of the smart fishing rod?
Oh, none.
Well, some of you are lying completely about this time. Sure. So you take your fishing rod, you go down to the river or the lake or whatever, and you cast your line into the water, and as you watch your lure go, ooh, pop, I like sound effects. And your fishing rod remarks to you, you have not fished before, have you? And you look at your fishing rod, no, I haven't. And your fishing rod says, let me teach you. And your fishing rod interfaces with whatever data systems you have with you, your PDA, your iPhone, whatever. And your fishing rod proceeds to teach you how to fish. It tells you and shows you, if you have a video device with you, where you know, maybe a little monitor on the side of the fishing rod, or a monitor tank will just change its configuration. And it'll model how to do it. And then you do your cast, and then your fishing rod, which has internal sensors, will be able to tell you whether it was a good cast or not. And you interact with your fishing rod, and it will train you how to fish, and then it will suggest additional resources and recommend that you join the local fishing club. Ordinary objects, all of our ordinary objects will have this built-in capacity. That's what you call negotiated construction.
Never mind.
Jar of strawberry jam. Your jar of strawberry jam will interface with your kitchen and will recommend that it be served along with the peanut butter. The peanut butter, of course, is always on. Peanut butter is like that. And it will give you strawberry jam recipes. It will tell you about the history of the making of strawberry jam. It will recommend that you limit your intake of strawberry jam because you had a lot of jam this month. It will balance your other nutritional supplements to make up for the absence or lack of sugar, etc. Your objects will be able to sense compliance with you, your medical regime. They will know where they are. They will know what else is around. They will offer their services, or at the very least, they'll give the room a little bit more information to assist it in its conversation with you. And your use of a product will cause a ripple, a whole ripple effect throughout the network. You consume, this is the old saying, huh? When you consume, the old saying, circa 2050, when you consume a jar of strawberry jam, a new strawberry plant is planted somewhere in the world. Automatically. Global production systems will monitor and react to your resource consumption and everybody else's resource consumption and allocate resources accordingly. That's exactly the kind of thinking, and it's actually a couple predictions down. What do we learn from this? First of all, learn from gifted observers. The basis for this prediction is a science fiction letter. And it makes sense to read things like science fiction and even fantasy to learn about the sorts of things that could happen in the future. And second, predicting capacities is easy. Predicting, you know, smart podiums or smart tables or whatever is easy. But the trick here, if you're predicting a capacity, predict the existence of that capacity everywhere. The example I like to use a lot is writing. Okay, writing, once upon a time, writing did not exist, and then it existed. And it came into the world, and people started to think, well, okay, well, what's the impact writing is going to have on society? And, you know, originally, writing was located in very specific places, and you would go to a special room called the reading room to do things with writing, like read. Or you'd go to the writing room or the library, and you'd have special rooms for writing. But writing, particularly in a literary society, can be everywhere. Writing is wherever you need it. It's on the walls. It's on, well, it's probably on the ceiling. It's too small for me to read. It's being... but now I'm focusing on not sneezing. That should say something about the nature of interventionist neurons.
How am I doing here? Oh, I got lots of time. Assuming that's correct, it might not be. Okay, what do we learn from it? First of all, learn from gifted observers. Learn from science fiction writers. Second, predict the existence of the capacity everywhere. What makes writing so useful is it can be anywhere we want it. Now, imagine things like learning that way. Imagine things like connected intelligence that way. Imagine things like the pragmatic web that way.
Imagine what our society would look like and how our society would operate if all of our computers did not have keypads. The only input device we had was a wheel. Maybe a clicker. How would we communicate with each other? We can do it, we have. But what would that kind of system of communication look like? Interesting.
Hey, just an aside. Holo cells. Future number 7.
I don't know, year 2068. Here's what my day was like. First of all, I shifted my sensory input matrix to the holo self sitting at a desk in so I could be there for the meeting in Denver. And so I spent the morning at this meeting in Denver. And then at lunchtime, I transferred to the next holo self, which has been waiting patiently for me. Kind of like a book on a shelf. Probably it's not like a book on a shelf at all. It's been waiting for me, and so for the lunchtime, I took a walk through the Amazon Eco Reserve. Then after lunch, I did a stint, a volunteer stint, only 5 minutes, although it's really boring, as a comet watcher for the Hubble Four Space Telescope. And then after that, I shifted to another holo self, a corporate holo self, to have a meeting in Zurich. And then finally, I finished the day with my real self, quotation marks, in Cairo for a nice evening meal at the Show of the Pyramids. This is not unimaginable.
How does this happen?
Well, think of holo cells. Right now, we might say something like holo cells, we're thinking of something that's a virtual, right? But a holo self is not necessarily virtual. A holo self is any combination of biological, mechanical, and virtual artifact that can be attached to our sensory input perception. So anything you can think of, we attach our sense of sight, smell, balance, whatever, to that device. And that becomes the source of our perception. So being a holo self is just as real an experience as being a physical self. Indeed, for the duration that we're in a holo self, that is our self. Holo cells are, for all intents and purposes, artificial humans. But, you know, it's the same old story, right? When they first made holo cells, they made them to resemble humans with arms and legs, like a robot. But as time went by, people said, hey, this is stupid. Why are we making holo cells with arms and legs? Why don't we make them with wings? And so they did. And gradually, we got a wide range of different kinds of holo cells. And holo cells, when they are occupied, have all the rights and all the responsibilities of a human. In fact, they are a human. And one of the overriding problems that law enforcement has in the future will be distinguishing whether there's a person or an object or not. Because you don't know. People will prefer to have their own whole selves, but they'd be willing to share, particularly if it's an expensive piece of machinery like the Hubble Force Based Telescope, which costs, you know, a lot to produce the scent.
That's good.
And cognition takes place partially in the whole self, which is a lot of pre-processing and has embedded business logic, which creates a whole range of issues, and partially in the human brain, which is perceiving through the whole self. Questions of virtual identity become ridiculous, right? The question of, am I the same person in Denver as I am in Cairo, is kind of like asking, am I the same person tomorrow as I was today?
It's no more perplexing than that.
And there'll be full of fads. People will spend relaxing time as like whole of birds or whole of fish, we call it going stupid. There'll be transports. These will be whole selves made out of multiple people where each person plays the role of a sense or a function or, you know, a bodily organ. I'm going to be a liver today. Well, how does a liver perceive? How would a liver perceive the world if it had a brain? We will be able to answer these questions with whole selves. And then there will be the dubious practice that will be much debated in the school system, polo splitting. And that's occupying two polos at once. So while your students are sitting in their class, assuming they're still classes, they're sitting in their class, but they're also poloing, you know, across the world somewhere. That's kind of a neat thing to think about, isn't it? Now, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas? What happens in Vegas Polo stays in Vegas Polo. We can physically exercise while we holo sit in meetings, better physical fitness. Now that is taking the concept and working with it. Exactly. That's exactly the sort of thing that can be done. Because why do you need a brain in order to operate your body? Let the computer do that while you're doing something more interesting. So what do we learn from this bit of prediction? Well, first of all, inventions often serve a purpose. So think about the purpose, and that will often lead you to the invention. And that's what... that's good. Think about the purpose, and the comment I was just made, right? Like getting exercise, right? There's the purpose. You want to get exercise, but you don't want to spend your time to do it. And there's the invention. Having your body and software that will manage your body for you to do the exercise while you play video games and run. Second, and keep that remark in mind too. This reminds you of the Wizard of Oz. If you dream as your whole self, is it real? On what grounds would you say it is not? Now, the question of whether it is volitional is another question, because holo selves may have implanted dreams. Second, keep in mind that the way we perceive the world can change, does change, will change. The way we perceived the world before and after we had language was fundamental and life-altering. And the way we perceive the world before and after we have the artificial hippocampus will be equally fundamental and equally life-altering. And if you look it up, they have already built the artificial campus. And finally, keep in mind, and this is actually here in my... Oops, I hit running out. It's actually there in my notes. people can and will abuse the technology, and you have to take that into account when you're making predictions.
That's a very interesting remark. Future number 8, living art.
Words and sentences are what we use to communicate today. Case in point, I am presenting in words and sentences. Interestingly, I'm doing it orally without text to accompany me, which means you have to sit there and listen if you want to figure out what it is I am saying, which creates a slightly different experience for you than if you could just read the slides and then you wouldn't have to listen to what I was saying in order to know what was going on. But now, you listen to what I'm saying, you know what I'm saying, you read the slides, you get confused. Well, words and sentences will be, my slide says, abandoned. That's a bit too strong. But they will cease to be the dominant mode of communication in the future. Instead, people will begin to use multimodal artifacts as words. Well, we already see this. I almost fell over. We already see this in things like YouTube videos and lolcats. And if somebody could link to lolcats on the slide there, I would appreciate it. And those of you who are following along, there is a link on the input form to the archive. So if somebody can input the link, you can follow along and actually get to that link to the computer if you don't have to type anything out. The lolcats are simply culturally bound visual artifacts intended to make a culturally relative point. We're not always sure what that point is. The sender isn't necessarily sure. The receiver isn't necessarily sure. But there's enough knowledge of what that point is so that we all know that it's hilarious. That's a lolcat. But we use other kinds of artifacts to communicate other kinds of ideas in the future. And again, our powers of expression will, and of course the tools that help us express ourselves, are going to become increasingly sophisticated already today. Yeah, think about when you were a kid. Most of you are my age, you're at different things, 20 years, right? Which means when you were a kid, the dominant mode of content production was either a typewriter or a pen and pencil. Right? Think about what you could produce when you were a kid. Think about the artifacts you were a pretty limited set. Now, if we look over there, we've got the journalism student producing videos, right, in an afternoon. Quite literally in an afternoon. When they played that video this morning, I was half expecting to see myself in it because they did record it, but then I realized the rendering time was actually longer than the time between, anyhow, so I knew I wouldn't be in it, but, you know, given the proper computer in the future, I would have been in it. Our creative capacity is dramatically extended, and extended in such a way that we are no longer bound and required to use words and sentences as we were in the past. And since we're no longer limited to words, we will no longer limit ourselves to words. Now, our expressions are not simply going to be digital artifacts either. I have already seen, some of you may have already seen, printers that print out objects. It's a really very simple system. A printer that prints an object will lay down some dust of whatever sort, and it'll lay down some glue. And the dust, it just lays down a layer of dust, and then it lays down a pattern of glue. And then it lays down another layer of dust, another pattern of glue. Like you shake all the excess dust off, and you have a three-dimensional object that gives you a printing. Very simple system. And the dust, typically what they use now is plaster dust or some sort of thing, but it doesn't have to be plaster dust. It can be protein. And if you can print protein-based objects that are in some way bound together, you can produce artifacts that, for all intents and purposes, can become life. You can produce living artifacts. And when we can produce living artifacts, we will think it's very stupid to use words and sentences in order to communicate our intent. We've seen examples. Those of us who have gone to Harry Potter movies have seen examples. Think of what a wizard does when a wizard wants to send a message. A wizard does not take a quill and write out the message. A wizard creates an owl. And the owl, it's a smart object, right? The owl self-propels itself to wherever Harry Potter is, because it always goes to Harry Potter. Never to someone else. Most of the time, the owl goes straight to Harry Potter, and then Harry Potter and the owl have a conversation. And the owl does not carry the message. The owl is the message. The owl embodies the message. And when Harry Potter converses with the owl, Harry isn't just, you know, listening to what the owl says, but he's interacting, interrogating, communicating with it, engaging in a process. And so the owl contains not just the message, but anything that might possibly be relevant to either the wizard or Harry or a third party. You don't read the owl, you interact with it, you converse with it. You know, and we think of communications traditionally as, you know, a way of carrying information or conveying information, but communications in the future we will think of more properly as actually being the information. See, now, that's a lolcat, except without text. See, now, if you guys were really on the ball, you'd get a picture like this, you'd put it into your Flickr account, you'd open Picnic Editor, you'd put a sentence on that picture which was relevant to the conversation that's happening here, and then you'd post it. You'd produce an instant lolcat to make a point. And interesting, and you'd make the point using culturally relevant artifacts. You'd be speaking to each other through the shared language of culture. Remember the person who said to me, or said in the thing when I talked about the Rough Riders, how sports scores and the economy, any idea of connecting those is ridiculous? Well, it's not ridiculous, is it? We just used Captain Kirk to make a point in an educational conference. I'm not sure what the point was, but it's not ridiculous. Our expressions may be sentences in the future. I mean, language won't vanish. Our expressions may be conventional icons. Think about when you send somebody a white rose. Same sort of thing. Think about when you send somebody a red rose. Different message, right? And our expressions in the future will carry not just semantical meaning, but pragmatic meaning. They will be embedded and part of this global conversation that we're having with our local communities. Now, our people will abuse this system. We'll have unwanted messages. We'll have living graffiti, for example, on walls. So it'll be like, when you walk down the street, it'll be slime drawing on the walls. And the slime will say, like, eat me. And it'll be possible. And the crews will have to go out and spray the slime off the walls and into the organic recycling centers. And as the comment earlier, but food that offers itself. We will actually be delivered spam, and it will be spam. And we will be able to eat it. It will be an artificially generated food source that will have a message. And spam will be used to advertise. It will be food that offers itself to you, and when you accept it, it will say, eat a ghost, or whatever. Or eat. The best place to advertise. This is from my notes here. The best place to advertise, said boy genius Chang Li in 2028, is in their food, because everybody eats. Well, almost everybody. I will be accepting the organizer's apologies. All right, what have we learned from this set of predictions? Well, first of all, once again, technology will be misused. Secondly, technology isn't just machines, especially in the future. We have to go beyond the domain of the digital, beyond the domain of the mechanical. Imagining what things will be in the future means going well beyond the productive capacities of today. And third, and I think most important, fantasy implies potentiality. Fantasy matters. Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction author, used to say, any sufficiently advanced science is indistinguishable from magic. But the corollary to that is, any magic is sufficiently advanced science. Future 9. Almost there. I've got 4 minutes. Global non-government. Now, this may be a bit obvious, but in the future, nations will become obsolete. And this will be caused mostly from the clamor of refugees from the impoverished societies of Europe and North America attempting to get back to their ancestral homelands, the now economically successful heartlands of China, India, and Central Africa. The powerhouses. Governments, because of this massive migration, will be not of geographical area, but of sectors. Economic sectors, productive sectors, cognitive sectors. Think today, even, the way we govern ourselves internationally, we have things like standards councils, which actually govern virtual artifacts or standards. It's really kind of an interesting thing when you think about it. We have professional associations that govern a certain profession, trade groups, etc., world trade groups, economic groups, international banking consortia, all of these things. These are sectors, and the governance of these things happens in the sectors rather than in the nations. And what will happen? Well, first of all, nations will no longer be allowed to govern some things. For example, the fisheries. After the world went virtually extinct of fish in the year 2025, the people of the world decided that nations should no longer be allowed to manage fisheries because nations would not manage the fisheries properly. And so a World Fisheries Council was put into place that actually overruled national governments on fisheries. And thus we see proof that I am not, in fact, identical to David Crosby. That is a lolcat. And a live-produced lolcat, from the looks of it. That's really good. Other industries that are governed by international bodies rather than national bodies, again, because of the disasters that have happened, aviation, food production, finance. We're already seeing these things being governed internationally. And as each national government mismanages a little bit, the international government becomes more and more prevalent. The international government won't manage it any better. And indeed, there will be a significant change in how we manage these international bodies after the fiasco of the 2050s, where the oligarchical system that organizes world trade and world finance and that caused the great disaster, whatever, I don't know what it is, but it cost the lives of millions of people, and we have a completely unrepresentative sector council managing something that had the potential to impact anyhow. There was a mass uprising, and these things became, well, not democratic, because it doesn't make sense to have votes on these things anymore, but open. It became called the Free Movement, and was a result of there was an after effect of the war between governments and corporations, and it's essentially a power sharing agreement. The governments themselves disappeared, so the corporations could say that they won, right? So there are no elections, but people cooperatively manage the section in which they are involved. People who fish manage the fisheries. people who farmed managed farming, people who were in oil managed oil, but all of the people in those sectors, not just the producers, the way we do it now. That's what the source of the problem has been. The producers, the consumers, anybody with an interest in that sector takes part in the management of that sector. And interest in this case is self-declared. The governance of the sector is the open governance. That was the other side of the government corporation wars. Government was dissolved at the urging of corporations, but the closed system run by corporations was dissolved at the urging of government. That was the Great Compromise of 2053.
Management, properly so called, which depends on coercion, and remember we live in a society of abundance, management effectively disappears, which means that the coordination of the sector has to be a coordination, has to be the result of a collection of interactions of mutual value between individuals. And if you wonder what sort of example could possibly look like that, we had one, in fact, in the late 1990s, we called it the Internet. And it was run by protocols, not by management. The invisible body of society, economists called it in 2048. And each person in this invisible body of the economy, each individual human, creates, I'm trying to read this, it doesn't make any sense. Oh yeah. Each individual creates and contributes to the individual body of the economy, and they each make their own decisions, they each manage themselves, they each govern their own input to something, and that's how the mission to Mars was accomplished. Each person contributing something to this on a voluntary basis. On an as-needed basis, and interestingly, according to their own abilities and their own skills. Now you might think we cannot manage without managers, but we are learning today, we saw George talk a bit about it, and November talked a bit about it, and we are seeing that when people have the freedom and when they have the capacity to create, to contribute productively, and when they're connected in an open, non-coercive network, that in fact, these networks can self-organize. And we know that this is the case in theory, we know that this is the case in practice, and there are plenty of examples of this. I ran in my newsletter a neat little example not too long ago. What do they call those things? The word's not in my mind.
Metronome.
Thank you. Metronome. So you take five metronomes, you put them on a thin piece of wood, right? They're just sitting on the table, each metronome does its own thing. You pick up the piece of wood, and you put it on a set of bricks. So now the piece of wood kind of bends from the weight of the metronomes. Now, the ticking of each metronome now has an impact on the wood, causing the wood to vibrate ever so briefly, ever so slightly. And consequently, as a result, the ticking of one metronome can influence another metronome. And you leave these things just ticking on their own, and eventually they tick in concert. And there is video of that on the web, and I actually ran it by this other. And that is not, a gee whiz isolated phenomenon. Duncan J. Watts talks about crickets. Now, crickets, we know that crickets are not organized. There is no head cricket. There never will be a head cricket because crickets are stupid. They don't follow orders. But when crickets chirp, they can hear each other chirp. And over time, because they can hear each other chirp, that causes a slight delay in their own chirping, crickets will eventually chirp in unison. It's a simple network effect. And it has been and is mathematically describable. And that is how you can manage in the future without managers. What do we learn from this? First of all, kingdoms don't last forever, despite absurd fictions like, galactic emperors and things like that. And in all likelihood, representative democracy won't last forever either. Representative democracy is a function of the philosophical movement that preceded it.
of atomism and algebra and counting and numeracy, and the system of governance is going to reflect the mathematics and the theory of today and in the future. And that mathematics and that theory is not going to be limited to the simple counting of entities. It will be based on descriptions of how these entities are related, which is why the things that George Siemens talks about are very important and will shape the way we structure our educational system in the future. And then the other thing we need to learn from this is we need to factor into our predictions dogged persistence and resistance to change and control, the desire of people to run their own lives, the desire of people to be out of the thumb of, go from under the thumb of chains and governments and business and whatever. People basically just want to live their own lives and not be told what to do. And this is always going to factor into what the future looks like. Prediction number 10, and I'll make this quick, because it's the easiest prediction of all, cyborgs. And the only thing preventing us from doing it now is the fact that we can't make our technology small enough and complex enough to interface with neurons. But we're rapidly heading in that direction, and when it happens, as people like Ray Kurzweil point out, it will be much more than a simple interaction between computers and neural nets. With biocomputing and nanotechnology, we'll be able to build, you know, spare memories, we'll be able to transfer, augment, and basically become part human, part computer. Not just human body parts, although that will be part of it, of course, but actual human, part mechanical, or part bioneural circuitry. And it won't even feel odd to us. It'll just feel like we're learning so much more, because we'll be developing new connections in our bioneural nets. You know, the initial successes of this movement will be artificial perception, which I've already talked about a bit, replacing the eyes, the ears, the nose, replacing the hippocampus, and so on. And a lot of questions are going to come up. You know, and I'm thinking of someone like Anne McCaffrey has explored these things. If you are a shit, are you still a human? Can a person be a shit and not become insane? And how would we know? How do you entertain a shit when it's important? When metaphor, a human as a shit, becomes reality, it's going to become a major issue and indeed a right to know what your current ontological situation is. A person who is a shit has a right to know that they are a shit. A person who is a human has a right to know that they are a human. And you should not fool a person who is a ship into thinking that they are a human. There will be a whole set of human conventions on this. Now, this is important because we know people are going to abuse this technology. And there are going to be, I'll tell you right now, seriously bad cases, and we need to prepare for them now, of virtual enslavement, hollow delusions, and the rest. You know, and what's the lesson of this and indeed of this entire talk? Ways of thinking, from logic to communication system to magic and fantasy, ways of thinking tend to become reality. In the past, we moved from a society that focused on the concrete to a society that focused on the abstract. And the abstract became real. Today we are moving from a society that focuses on the abstract, a society that focuses on words and language and grammar and syntax and mathematics, to a society that focuses on the metaphorical, the visual, the multimedial, the multimodal. And these things will become real. And they won't necessarily replace the old, just in the way that the abstract didn't replace the concrete. But they're going to play major roles in the way we see ourselves, and the way we create our society, and the way we create our values and our systems. Think today about how much of what we value is based on our concept of the abstract. and concepts of number. Things like one person, one vote, for example. Things like the essential, the need of everybody to be literate and numerate, for example. In the future, things that are based on metaphor, things that are based on illusion, on magic, will be as important and as concrete and everyday in our lives as abstract things are today. And it's this general principle that allows us to predict the future. This general principle that we can make the world what we think the world is going to be. Now, the future isn't this unwritten thing that happens to us. The future isn't something that is simply unknown and unpredictable. The future, like the past, is our own creation. And so, to understand the future, we study ourselves and we study our artifacts, not just to know what the world is, but to know what the world will be. And with that, I thank you.